was, let me give the, if I can, the next slide. There we go. Giving this, just, you don't need to see this really, but it backs up what I'm about to say, which is that, yes, have been a private equity attorney specializing in that, have clients such as Apollo, KKR, SoftBank, JP Morgan, guys who are probably not the most popular ones in the room from what I've heard so far today. I'm not here as an advocate for them, certainly I couldn't be, and I'm not necessarily here as an advocate for private equity either. Rather, I'd like to argue that private equity itself as a mechanism, as a structure, is fundamentally neutral, and that it's really the actors behind it that are either doing something desirable or something undesirable. I'm here at this conference as a result of some conversations with another speaker who was here, in which she was describing frustration and uncertainty with private equity entities that were sitting between a DFI and the fundamental investment. So I'm trying to dispel those uncertainties and at least show some possibility of remedy for that frustration. Now, it can't all change. There's a quick jumping ahead to the end in a way. Looking at all that private equity money that's already out there, what can you do about it? It's probably not going to change, except out of regulation. There's not going to be a silver bullet. There can be regulation, or there can be influence through one of the principal investors. I would say my best guess off the top of my head would be go after the pension funds, go after the legislatures of the states that host those pension funds. So to talk about private equity itself, I first want to deconstruct it a little bit and get away from the thought that private equity is what we view private equity in action today. Private equity, in its most simple form, is simply transactions that don't involve public stock funds. That's it. Let's go to something we can probably relate to. So an individual purchases a house. Right now you have a private equity transaction. If that individual purchased with a loan that was secured by a mortgage against that to-be-purchased home, well, they just did a leveraged buyout. Not only that, but those financial records are secret. So we're starting to touch on a lot of the things that often are red flags, but still, it's a fairly innocent transaction. Well, for estate planning purposes, that individual uses a trust or corporation to purchase the house. Well, now, even in the land title office, you won't be able to find their name of the individual. You could with a little work. But this is getting on a lot of the red flag issues that I think private equity practice, in practice today, as it's been identified in this room, concerns people. But I want to point out that really this is kind of the default condition for a lot of transactions. Confidentiality is the default condition. Setting things up, doing a private equity transaction is pretty normal. I mean, if you could call a quart of milk something you could have equity in, when you buy a quart of milk, you're doing private equity. So let's have a somewhat more expected example, which is, we've seen this before, so I don't spend too much time on it, but this is institutionalized private equity. So we saw this morning, so I won't go through the whole explanation, but I want to focus particularly on the top row. And I've cheated here by calling them co-investors. Really, they are limited partners, and I've cheated because you often have situations where multiple funds will make an investment in a portfolio company, in which case those funds are called co-investors, and a lot of the same features that I'm going to talk about later apply to that subsequent condition, but I'm not going to deal with it separately. So we can look at them as LPs here, they're co-investors later. What happens when you start, I'm just going to skip why do private equity, I think we've talked about this enough, other than, in a way, why not? You do private equity because it's fast, it's flexible, it is efficient. Private equity as an institutional model is attractive to many persons because it allows them to take advantage of a team of, if you have a good firm, very capable people with access to tremendous resources that can apply that level of capability across their research and their negotiating and their purchase and their subsequent management of a portfolio company. And I want to stress that last part because from what I've heard today and otherwise, it sounds like there's a little bit of fire and forget going on. both at the funding of a fund level and at the purchase of a portfolio company level, that somebody writes a check and then they're done. In the practice I've come from, that is not at all the case. The oversight is inescapable. Now this one, I think we can skip. I'm trying to be fast. Okay, here, well, let me talk about a little bit what private equity is not. It is not per se by itself an effort to hide things. It is not an effort to fire people. In fact, I don't think I've ever been on a deal with, certainly some members of management, it's to be expected, as we've heard. As far as employees, I'm pretty sure I've never been on a deal where there was a firing plan, and in fact, usually it's the opposite. There's retentions. I've been on a deal sitting on the 40th floor of Rockefeller Center where KKR, in fact, said, we will not do this deal unless you guarantee that those 400 employees in Wyoming keep their jobs at their current levels for at least a year, other than with cost. So it certainly happens. It certainly happens. And I think a lot of people remember the infamy of Barbarians at the Gate and RJR Nabisco and ripping companies apart. Well, one, that was the 80s, and it was a response to the consolidation period of the 60s and 70s. We've got, you know, RJR Nabisco, they make cigarettes and crackers. ITT made satellites and Hostess Twinkies. AMF made tennis rackets and Harley Davidsons. You know, there was a certain logic to tearing those companies apart. And you don't see that much of it today. Sure, you see some. Also, private equity is going to be very different in different contexts. In an investment in a developed country versus a developing country, the nature of it's going to be very, very different as far as what the investor, and again, I'm talking about a purely financial investor, is going to think they want to do. We looked into, one, what, go away. All right, there we are. This is the line I'd wanted to emphasize, still just defining the fund itself. So the fund always has, it pretty much always has, there are exceptions, pretty much always has multiple limited partners. And this morning we saw them as a monolith. But initially, they're going to have to come together, and there are several ways that they're going to do this. One is that somebody really starts the whole thing off, either as they are simply running a fund, and they say, we're starting a new fund, who wants to come in which case it's a free-for-all, sort of, pretty exclusive free-for-all. Or somebody who, in fact, has the initial seed money starts a fund. This would be the case with a bank-sponsored fund or, as we want to look at here, a DFI-sponsored fund. The negotiating position, there is a negotiation. It's not simply a blank subscription. People come together and they start negotiating. I mean, the bigger you are, the more you can do. But if you're the guy who had the money and started the fund, well, you're writing the paper first. It's not a universal, commoditized system. You can write anything you want. There's going to be a partnership agreement amongst these people. So in that agreement, things like what you can invest in, who has veto rights, no matter how much money they put in. If they don't accept the deal and you don't get into the paper, then forget it. But anybody could have a veto right. Anybody could have an opt-out right, which means that if there is an investment which is not proper for them to make, they can leave. Rights of internal governance, rights of sending reports back up to the limited partners or sending reports, making reports available to the public. Anything within the law is available if there's active participation. So I've got a series of points here where we looked at, well, what might a DFI be frustrated with? And these are largely focused on if a DFI is investing is an LP in a fund, which then makes subsequent investments. That's the basic model. My language probably is I say acquisition an awful lot. It could just as well, for the most part, be a greenfield development or an investment. Little variations amongst there, but they'll say acquisition every time. So in this case, when you're setting up, when you're arguing amongst those potential limited partners, there are going to be a lot of differences. In particular, with something like a development-oriented group, development-oriented group has an agenda in addition to making money. It's very easy when everyone just wants to make money. It's a remarkably fungible commodity. But if you have, well, we are really interested in achieving this goal, or we are really interested in achieving these things in this area, and we specifically want to avoid these things, you're going to get quite a lot of, it's going to be quite a matrix when it's not a pure money play. But that's the negotiation. And so the DFI has to get in the room and do the talking. And if they can't get their provisions in, or if they aren't comfortable with the provisions they got plus an opt-out, then they walk away. I think there's been a problem where they've just written the check, and then they see their money going somewhere that they never wanted it to go to. Well, there are ways of dealing with that, both just pure negotiation, but also here I've monetized it. If the DFI has certain non-monetary interests, well, then some of its profit share can be reallocated to some of the guys who have a higher pure monetary interest. And you can shuffle around like that. There are little knobs that can be played with to reconcile this. It doesn't have to be a win-lose fight. Okay, and here I kind of describe it. So the management company, after funding, did something that doesn't fit with what the DFI is supposed to do or what it wanted to do. Well, the partnership agreement should have been written better. DFI should have done its job, hire more lawyers. It's important. It's one of the cheapest ways to save money is hire lawyers.
I think we knew that already, so it's fine.
And as I said, the opt-out rights and veto rights, and these are absolutely typical. Even in pure money funds, which I have more experience with, you have groups that are, for instance, these pension funds that we've heard mentioned. Pension funds have strict restrictions on what they can invest in. And pension funds are a major part of the funding of almost any fund. And so these partnership agreements go into great lengths of, okay, well, if this happens, then we have to do that. You can't do this, you can do this, but if you do, then I'm out, and you know I can true up my funds this way. It gets pretty detailed. Those things are available. So they are available to the DFI as well, but they've got to get them in before the check get written. Okay, this is one that's come up quite a bit today. These things become opaque, both to the DFI and outside observers. This is it's business confidentiality. You try to call the fund, God, if you cold called any of my funds, it would be an interesting call to hear. They're not going to do it. I mean, they have no reason to. Unless, again, it's been written into the partnership agreement. You've got to do it before you write the check. That's the whole thing. You know, hold the money and keep talking. You write it in their partnership agreement, they can do anything you write. So you can have all the reporting required to either be sent out directly from the lower levels or sent back up into the DFI to the same level where people are accustomed to finding it today. So you could say, all right, make it so that in the same location, the same degree of information is made available. Done. You know, not every time. I mean, if you're the 10% player, probably not going to work. And you have to then, somebody has to make the decision of, well, is that acceptable or not? And maybe the DFIs have internal rules where they say we cannot go into anything unless we can achieve, you know, these several criteria. In a general acquisition scenario, and this is where it's handy to have these the competent people in a good firm. They're doing research, and these are people who are highly trained. They're usually pretty quick. And they know the area or the industry or whatever it is they're meant to look at, they're familiar with. They do a lot of research, they identify a potential project, or we call it a target, and they make a proposal to the management company, which is what really runs the firm. And they start running evaluation and looking at what we'll call a business plan, which is they're doing a lifetime plan for this thing, which is very holistic. Well, not, what's it going to cost to buy it, obviously, and then the loan burden, what kind of materials does it need, does it have critical suppliers, what are our exit strategies, what's it going to look like at the exit, trying to anticipate all the problems down the road, and then if it passes that test, we go into due diligence, which I've heard a couple of comments about due diligence today, that it's quite cursory, and you know, maybe you get somebody saying, yes, everything's fine. Which I've encountered as well. I did a lot of work in China, and there was a lot of, yes, everything is fine. What we are typically used to is, depending on the size of the company and the nature of the company, days of time on site, lawyers, accountants, experts, going through files, visiting the facility, touring the facility, not always talking to, but observing the employees, talking to management, and really asking the hard questions. Getting a sense, obviously verifying everything we saw, and getting a sense of the place itself and the people themselves, their credibility, and anything that didn't come up before. We gather all that information, including the uncertainties. There's some things which either they can't tell us, or they don't know, or it's a third-party issue. And we identify those uncertainties, and then this goes back up into the valuation and business plan. Okay, was our valuation right? Is it in fact viable over the foreseen period and for what we expect it's going to do? And again, this isn't just companies. I mean, this could be a project finance thing. What's necessary? A greenfield project finance. What are we going to need? Let's go in there and see. Well, you know, you need certain supplies, and is this going to work? And then let's go back and crunch the numbers and really do the math. Then that goes into negotiation and the purchase agreement, which again is a very, very rigorous document into which all this diligence information comes in, and wherein the seller, or what would be the equivalent of a seller, it's going to be a different thing in different scenarios, is going to represent and warrant that these things are true. The shortest part of a purchase agreement is the purchase of for X dollars, we'll buy that. And then there are about 30 or 40 more pages, which are all these representations and warranties, covenants as to the future performance by the company itself or by whatever the thing is, indemnification to protect the purchasing party against, we'll get into it a little bit later, but to protect the purchasing party against error, let's say, and then the purchase itself. So back to the issues. So if you get a lousy, you get a dud. Why? Basically, somebody was doing a bad job, or somebody was, you know, they're both doing a bad job. But the first one is really just a lack of rigor or a lack of expertise. And the second one is the blank check syndrome, which again, I think is endemic from what I've been hearing of some of the problems that have come up. And both of these need to be addressed by just being a little bit more aggressive, being a little bit more involved, having strict controls, being more involved during the investment. And the easiest way is time managers' returns. It's easy on paper. It's really not as effective. It's a little better to have more direct involvement. But I'd say the biggest thing about it is that you got the wrong guy. I'd say proposal, really shorthand, fire him. That may be sound mean, but it's, you know, his ripple effect is tremendously greater. So as far as impact on the project and you know, the true concerns of the DFI. So now we've got one which is viable and legal, but it's got some small things which are undesirable. It has some relationships with affiliates or with its principal supplier is actually owned by someone you don't like. And these things are a little hard to find. They're hard to articulate in a partnership agreement. They could come up in diligence. Sometimes they're a little too elusive for that. But really, this throws the burden back up to the DFI again, and I'm going to continue to argue the active role for the DFI. There's a lot to do after writing the check. The DFI should look at what's proposed and think about it and think, oh, well, do we have a particular sensitivity in this area? Maybe we do, because I mean, DFI is one of several LPs, so the management company can't anticipate everything. They are not a pure proxy for the DFI. So if the DFI has particular sensitivity, they need to write this requirement into the partnership agreement that when you have a proposal, you let us know. And we're going to put together a supplemental diligence list, and you're going to get your guys and send them in there, not just call the guy and say, is this okay? Send them in there, figure it out. And if you can't figure it out, then quantify that risk, and we're going to bake it into the agreement. So now we've got some where it's a new company. This would apply to a venture deal. This would apply to just something that's a little mysterious. The seller party is completely honest. In good faith, cannot really say. This thing could be worth $10 million, could be worth $50 million. I think there is a tendency in non-closely monitored funds to just go ahead and buy it. Particularly where you've got a guy who's it's not his money, and he's the one talking to the seller, and they, you know, they're getting along fine. Sure, let's do it. I mean, he won't go for the 50, but it'll be 40 or something. Well, it doesn't have to be. That's the blank check syndrome problem again. It doesn't have to be that way. There are ways to structure deals so that you don't have to just eat the risk like that. The thing called the earnout, which means you're going to, some of the purchase price, you may say, you know, we will pay up to 50 for this thing. Today we're going to pay you 10. We're going to put the remaining 40 in escrow. And at 6 months, we're going to see what the performance is. At 1 year, whatever is appropriate to the thing purchased. We're going to look at it. We'll have certain measurements we are articulating today. And these funds are there. They're delivered. And then the escrow will be released. If not, then the escrow is not released. So then, and purchase price adjustment is very much the same way. The Greenfield project, the milestones, it's a very similar concept, although you're dealing with a blank slate, and you're simply saying, by this time you need to get this thing done, by that time you need to get that thing done, and then this additional piece of funding will come in. And this really goes to the good business plan, the rigorous business plan, and not just the sounds like a great idea business plan. Now, in this case, innocent or not, the representations that you got out of diligence and the information from the seller turned out not to be true. And this can be, if it's actual fraud, if it's really bad, then things get really serious. But a very typical provision in purchase agreements is an indemnification clause. And this means it's a set of escrowed money, part of the purchase price, sits off in a bank, earning interest, and is held for amount of time that you determine. And if there turns out to be a breach of any rep or warranty during that period, during the articulated period, and there's usually a lifetime to these things. Some are unlimited, but usually you put a lifetime and it's just realistic. You have to kind of get the deal done and move along. And sometimes you can stage them. In 6 months, we'll release half the funds and then we'll hang on to the rest. To give the buyer a chance to really see, is this really what I thought I bought? And if not, you're going to keep it in most cases, and it's pretty hard to put it back. But you can calculate what your degree of risk is and monetize that into a reduction in purchase price that's going to be determined by is going to be funded by this indemnification. So you're like, well, if the guy is wrong on that, then what's that worth to us? And really, you don't have to figure it out too much ahead of time. You just have to figure out what your total indemnification should be. If there's a lot of risk, you make it pretty high. And then when a breach occurs, there are certain materiality thresholds, a lot of details that are important here, then the value of that breach is determined, and that amount, it goes back to the buyer. Key persons part. This we can be quick on. This often, key people, sometimes employees will leave when they think a company's up for sale. Sometimes key people who got a bonus for the transaction will all of a sudden disappear. There are a lot of structures to deal with both of those. And I mean, the obvious one is if you're buying a company from a founder, a lot of times they get $1 million or something at the signing, and then they're gone. And if they were just hanging out at the country club anyway, you don't really care. But sometimes these guys, it's the scientist or something, and you really want to make sure that when he gets his check, he doesn't run off. And there are plenty of ways of dealing with that. And that's just to make sure that you still have the people on the ground that you need. Usually it's really more the management team. The dozen people who are getting this thing going and keeping it going, and on whom you based your valuation and your expectations. You want to make sure they stick around for at least a transition period. That's all doable through contract. This is key and very short, I promise. After the purchase, things don't stop. This sort of goes, it replicates what I was saying about the formation of the fund. You don't stop once you bought the thing. The management company, and this goes again to why private equity funds can be useful, because you have some good people who are so good that they would not be employed full-time at this one company. So you're taking their capabilities and spreading it across enough companies that you're using them up. And the companies are getting the advantage of what they can do. So there are people in the management company or people whom the management company have brought in who are going to be actively monitoring these things. And the fund, the DFI, should be doing the same thing. Or the reporting system should be adequate such that DFI doesn't have to, but I would put the burden on the DFI to make sure, not just go, yeah, we got the report, but read the report. Is this good enough? If it's not, get back in there. And that makes a big difference in making a success of the thing. Now we're in this post-purchase time, and this is a little bit similar to if upon purchase you found out that some of the reps and warranties were not accurate. The DFI may have put in special provisions that require the managers to do things which are not actually making money for them. It's not very attractive to them. And at the purchase time, they're like, yeah, absolutely, we'll do it. They're watching the check. But down the road, it starts slacking off. Well, those things need to be written in the purchase agreement as covenants and protected by indemnification. So you don't want to be in a position where you have to go and sort of say, hey, buddy, but there's still money sitting out there. Keep the money sitting out there. And if the covenant is breached, that money starts disappearing. Okay, let me go through quickly. Why might a DFI choose this structure? Okay, consortium. One is kind of the obvious way, the leverage we talked about. And I'll close up. With the question really I want to present is, I want to make two points. One, here, it's not private equity that really, private equity as a method, as a structure, that is the dilemma. It's the actors. It's, as I've said, it's like a pen. What are you going to write with it? It's a very capable pen. And if it's in your hand, Nick earlier used the term, extremely ruthless, I think. Well, wouldn't you want that? Right now, I'm afraid, from what I hear, you're confronting a universe of extreme ruthlessness, and it's unfortunate. But it doesn't have to be. The DFIs can do it as well. If they're just going to try to participate in what's already there, it's going to be a tough shite. Second, is it possible for a DFI to get the advantages of private equity without the loss of control, the compromise objectives, or allowing things to fall behind some veil of obscurity? I'd say yes. But I think it requires active, focused participation.